Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 6th of December 2013 here in Japan, and I am joined today from the United States by Dr. Bruce Levine of BruceLevine.net. And for those of you who don't know, Dr. Levine is on the ethical advisory board of the journal Ethical Human Psychology and Psychiatry. He is a practicing clinical psychologist, but he is often at odds with the mainstream of his profession, to say the least. And he is the author of numerous books, including Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite, quite a book title if ever there was one. He's also a previous guest on the Corbett Report, so people can look in the interview archives for our previous conversation. Dr. Levine, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Great to chat with you again.
Well, it is great to chat with you, especially because I have a very interesting topic lined up for today. I'd like to talk about DSM-5, and for those who don't know, the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders published by the American Psychiatric Association, the APA. And this is a manual that's been published, since 1952, and since then there have been 5 revisions to this over the past 6 decades, with the most recent revision coming just earlier this year, being published in May of this year, DSM-5. So for those of us out there who are not well versed on this or what the DSM is or how it functions, can you tell us a little bit about its history and what it's used for?
Sure. The DSM is really the Psychiatric Diagnostic Bible, and it's published by the American Psychiatric Association, which is the professional organization of America's psychiatrists. And I think it started out not as a very small little manual. It's a very, very little thin thing in 1952, about 100 disorders, and each revision grows larger and larger, and so DSM-5 is just huge, close to 400 diagnoses, and they didn't add as many as they did. There was a huge additions in these other ones. They didn't add as many in the DSM-5 as they had in previous ones, but what they did was they expanded criteria. What that will do ultimately is make for a lot more mentally ill people. And each one of these DSMs that come out, the bottom line is it creates more mentally ill people, which is good for psychiatry. It's good for drug companies, who, by the way, fund not only the American Psychiatric Association, but if you take a look at the task force that creates this board of trustees at the American Psychiatric Association who creates the DSM, the majority of them, almost 69% of them, were financially connected with these drug companies. And so that's a little bit, basically, we can talk a little bit if you're interested what really the criteria, it has very little to do with science, the criteria for inclusion is, and just how little science there is ever been in the DSM. In fact, it's one of those things that even most people in the mental health profession laugh about. But for some reason, it just goes on and on.
Well, absolutely. I think we should get into that. We should also, I think, circle back to the conflict of interest that you mentioned there with the board members and the connections to the drug industry. But let's talk about those criteria for inclusion. And I would direct people at this point to an article that you wrote on your Huffington Post blog back in February of this year, DSM-5, Science or Dogma, Even Some Establishment Psychiatrists Embarrassed by Newest Diagnostic Bible, in which you note that Dr. Alan Francis, who was one of the people who was on the was in fact one, I believe, chairing the board for the DSM-4, was critiquing the DSM-5 earlier this year, talking about how basically there has been a bereavement exclusion that has been removed from the DSM-5, meaning that people who are suffering from the loss of a loved one when accompanied by symptoms of depression will no longer be excluded from being diagnosed as actually clinically depressed. They're now going to be basically considered depressed. That's a pretty huge move, I think, and one that will affect millions of people potentially. So
right.
Perhaps we can talk
exactly
about that.
Exactly. That's the one that's going to expand how many people basically are going to be put on antidepressants, because now, in the past, if you just lost some person who was the most important person in your life, and you went into symptoms of depression for it afterwards, you had this thing called a bereavement exclusion, and somebody wasn't going to put you immediately on antidepressants, or at least they should not have done that. But now they're allowed to do that. So when you think about how many people are going through those grief processes where they significant losses happen, and now it's okay to put them on antidepressants right away, well, you can see how that could jack up the numbers considerably. The interesting thing when you're talking about Alan Francis, the chair of the DSM-IV task force, and also, too, the Robert Spitzer, who was the chair of the DSM-III task force, these are, you can't be more establishment psychiatrists than these two guys, and they have been, they're coming out against this DSM-5. Why is that happening? Well, if you take a look at history in general, when any institution gets really ridiculous, and the DSM has always been ridiculous, it's always been pseudoscientific. Again, most people within the profession joke about it and laugh about the silliness, the lack of validity, lack of reliability, lack of all kind of scientific dimensions. It's no more scientific than the Bible, than Genesis. But when it gets to the point of ridiculousness in terms of expansiveness, the people who are more sophisticated politicians within establishment psychiatry, and Alan Francis certainly is chair of the DSM-IV task force, and Spitzer, who is there's no more significant establishment psychiatrist in the last 50 years than Spitzer, you know, they're hip to when things get so ridiculous everybody's laughing at it and they want to jump off the sinking ship. And so really that's what's kind of happened with DSM-5. It's even establishment psychiatrists. In fact, Francis, for the last year or so, he's been out. He wrote a book about trashing the DSM-5, and he's all over the country saying the same thing that that took a lot more courage to say about 15, 20 years ago. But now it really even doesn't take any courage for establishment psychiatrists to be laughing at the DSM-5.
Well, that is pretty remarkable. And you bring up a couple of points about the scientific backing or lack thereof of the DSM in general. And you mentioned the points about validity and reliability. Perhaps we should talk a little bit about that and why this DSM really isn't scientific.
Right. I think people have to understand how does certain human behaviors become a mental illness? Well, it comes down to really a board of trustees at the American Psychiatric Association. What's their criteria? Well, it comes down to those behaviors that make them uncomfortable and which they gauge will make other people uncomfortable. And that's how come homosexuality was a mental illness in the 1952 DSM-1, in the 1968 DSM-2, and that's how come it got thrown out in the 1969. 1970, 70s, there were big gay activism, and they got sick of being called mentally ill. And so there is no scientific validity, and that's a huge part of what makes something scientific. Validity means is something like meaningful. So in other words, to give you a clear case, which I think even almost every psychiatrist would laugh at as being ridiculous, is that once upon a time, a long time ago in the 1850s, there was a doctor, a guy named Samuel Cartwright in Louisiana, who decided that slaves who ran away from their plantation suffered the mental illness of drapetomania, and that's what caused them to flee. I mean, that they had this illness. Why else would slaves want to flee the plantation? And so, of course, that's ridiculous. It's not valid. And so most psychiatrists would agree with that. Fortunately now, that most psychiatrists would agree that homosexuality is not valid mentally ill, but they still, consider things like oppositional defiant disorder, which teenagers get increasingly because they refuse. These are symptoms. Refuse to comply with adult requests and rules, argues with adults. So that for them, they consider as a valid mental illness based on their idea. What's their scientific reason for it? Well, there is none. It's just that those kind of kids make them uncomfortable because they're not compliant, and they gauge that enough Americans feel uncomfortable with these kind of stubborn, rebellious kids too that they can get away from it. That's not science. So there's no validity. The other issue of science, another major issue of science, is when you create something that categorizes people, is it reliable? So in other words, if you take the same person to several different psychiatrists, will they come up with the same diagnosis? Well, even if you believe in these silly things like oppositional defiant disorder and all the other kind of silly mental illnesses, which are basically invalid, let's just put the validity issue aside, you cannot get psychiatrists to agree on the same person. So we've done study after study on all of these DSMs, DSM-3, 4, 5, and there's no reliability. In other words, psychiatrists don't agree. So it's really a useless document, a useless manual in terms of any kind of scientific validity, any kind of scientific reliability. It's really no more scientific than Genesis. It's just really kind of almost, sometimes when I talk about the DSM, it's just hard to keep from laughing as people even bring up the idea that it's anything resembling science.
Well, perhaps it's appropriate that it's referred to as the psychiatric Bible, I guess. Well,
right.
Perhaps that's more than just a metaphor. Well, let's talk about another one of the interesting things that's been added to DSM-5. You bring up oppositional defiance disorder, which was added to DSM-3 back in, I believe, in 1980, which we talked about in our previous conversation. But DSM-5 adds disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, better known as temper tantrums. Let's talk about that.
Right. I mean, what they did, American Psychiatric Association, was that they realized so many of these kids were getting diagnosed with pediatric bipolar, which is another crazy kinds of thing. You have 3- and 4-year-olds being diagnosed with bipolar disorder. When you take a look at what 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds are, I mean, they're going to have grandiose ideas, delusions. They're going to have poor judgment, poor impulse control. And so basically this idea of pediatric bipolar disorder was created pretty much by this guy named Joseph Biederman at Harvard University, who Congress finds out in 2008 in their investigations of psychiatry, took $1.6 million from drug companies between 2000 and 2007. So this thing, pediatric bipolar disorder, thanks to a lot of people, including myself, I'm not the only one, I mean to say, we've been kind of, you know, talking about Biederman, talking about the silliness of this diagnosis to the point where it's become an embarrassment for psychiatry. So what do they do? Rather than just getting rid of this stuff, they decide to really come up with a kind of a pediatric junior or junior bipolar disorder light, you know, and call it disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Which the idea, they think, you know, is like, okay, if we call these kids who are having temper tantrums this disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, then they're not going to be treated like bipolar disorder, and they're not going to be given those kinds of, like, lithium and all these other major drugs that you give to kids for, that you give to people for bipolar disorder. Well, what we know is, though, that's not going to work that way. A kid gets any kind of a psychiatric diagnosis, and they're going to get drugged with major league dangerous drugs. For example, that oppositional defiant disorder, which is certainly a more lightweight diagnosis than disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Lots of those kids now are getting drugged with antipsychotics, especially if they're poor kids. So we know, for example, in a study in 2012 in Archives of General Psychiatry, we found out that there's a 7-fold increase in kids under 13 being put on antipsychotics, and 63% of them are for these so-called disruptive behavioral disorders, one of which being oppositional defiance disorder, that they're getting antipsychotics for. So it's total nonsense that the idea that you're going to give these kids a lighter diagnosis called disruptive mood dysregulation disorder and they're not going to be put on drugs. You're just going to have more kids being put on drugs, because it took a little bit for some psychiatrists to call a kid pediatric bipolar disorder. It's going to take nothing now for them to call every kid who their parents complain with, you know, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, any kid who gives their parents a little bit of a hard time, throws a little bit of a temper tantrum, boom, they're going to get that diagnosis, and they're going to be on some heavyweight drugs.
Well, I think we should definitely address the drug issue, because this seems to be the real heart of the issue and what's driving these different revisions and the expansion of the number of people who are included in them. And there are a lot of different aspects to this, but obviously you mentioned, for example, the overprescription of antipsychotics, which is now an $18 billion a year industry, one of the most prescribed class of drugs. Antidepressants, I believe, another $12 billion a year. Just incredible amounts of money, obviously, are being pumped into this and are facilitated by these DSMs. Let's talk about the drug issue and the influence of the drug manufacturers over the creation of this so-called Bible.
It's just huge. I mean, like I said, that about 69% of the people who are in the DSM-5 task force had ties to drug companies. And I think when folks hear these numbers, sometimes they get lost with, you know, million, billion, to kind of give folks a sense of how huge these antipsychotics are. Just one antipsychotic is now, this one called Abilify, which you might be seeing, on, at least in America here, we see on television being advertised regularly as a, that you could use for psychosis, you could use for depression as sort of like an antidepressant chaser, take it along with your Prozac. Well, this thing, Abilify, this is an antipsychotic, is on pace to gross $6 billion this year. So in the first quarter of 2013, it had already become the largest grossing of all drugs, not just psychiatric drugs. drugs. Seroquel, another antipsychotic, hit $6 billion in 2011. And so these are gigantic amounts of money. I mean, to kind of give people a sense of how big that kind of money is, Facebook only grossed $5 billion last year. Yahoo only grossed $5 billion this year. So one antipsychotic drug, okay, is grossing that much money. Well, how is that grossing it? Well, it's not being given just for kids with, it's just not being given for people who have psychoses. It's being given to control populations. I talked about kids. Huge billions of dollars are being made off of just controlling kids, but also old people in nursing homes. That's a lot of the places that they're being given. Also, folks in prison. That's where a lot of these drugs are being used. So any population out there of vulnerable people who authorities got pretty much complete control over, who they want to most easily control, they're getting control with these antipsychotic drugs, and that's why they're making so much money off of them.
How does the APA respond to criticisms of this sort? Because I'm sure they're not unaware of it, and I'm sure there must have been some sort of response that's been given over the years to the idea that there's drug manufacturer influence over this process.
I think what they say, it varies. I mean, originally, these guys were proud of their partnership. They used that word. We're proud of our partnership with pharmaceutical companies because they see themselves as a legitimate medical enterprise. They see themselves as purely a legitimate scientific enterprise, and these drug companies as purely caring about helping folks lead better lives. And they are in like this state of denial and delusions about how much this whole thing is all about money. So that's what you'll hear from them. Of course, they'll give lip service. Yes, there's certainly over medication, and there's bad apples, and this is the kind of stuff they'll talk about. And they'll never say that the whole enterprise is corrupt. The whole enterprise is pseudoscientific. The whole enterprise has been completely first corrupted by drug companies, and now drug companies have pretty much annexed psychiatry as they have for other parts of medicine as well. They're not going to say that.
No, of course they're not. It's just rather amazing that that this hasn't been addressed more thoroughly, given that this is, I assume, the main criticism and one that, again, they're not unfamiliar with, especially with the former the chair of the DSM-4 task force coming out so strongly in opposition to DSM-5. It kind of boggles the mind that there hasn't been more of a concerted effort to try to address this issue. Who is the task force chair for DSM-5?
I don't know. I don't know who the DSM-5 task force chairman was for that.
Well, perhaps in a decade or two when DSM-6 comes out, he'll be writing against that. Who knows?
Right, if he's got a book deal.
Yeah, well.
I mean, that's what all he says. I mean, I hate to be cynical about Alan Francis because he's saying all the right things right now, but he was the chairman of the DSM-4 task force, and he knew if he had a half a brain, which he does clearly, that whole thing was a pseudoscientific joke. And so now, as he's retiring, he gets himself a good book deal with a major publishing company, now he's speaking truths about now he's trashing DSM-5, as is a similar case to Robert Spitzer, who's the DSM-3 chairman of DSM-3 task force. By the way, my favorite Spitzer quote was, he said he's the DSM-3 comes out in 80, he's the chairman of DSM-3 task force. And in 1989, there's a quote from him where he's bragging about, and he says, I could just get my way by sweet talking and whatnot. I could just get my way by sweet talking and whatnot. This is a guy bragging about the joke of like how much power he had in terms of one guy controlling what these diagnoses were in this DSM. And if that doesn't get folks to understand how there's complete lack of science here, it's completely about politics. I don't know what will.
Unfortunately so, and I was actually watching an interview with Dr. Francis in which he mentioned that he lost his own wife about 5 years ago and went through the grieving process himself, and so it's interesting there might be kind of a personal motivation to see a threat in the DSM-5 and the removal of the bereavement exclusion in his case specifically. But regardless of that, I mean, I think the points that these people are making, the Spitzer and Francis's of the world, are making valid points about this, even if we can question their motives for doing so. And of course, once again, this does come back to the validity and reliability of this. And in that regard, perhaps the most famous study to question the validity and reliability of psychiatric diagnoses was the 1973 study by David Rosenhan, which was reported in Science. And for those who don't know, there's a compelling account of it in an Adam Curtis documentary, I believe Century of the Self, although it may have been a different documentary, but quite an interesting study. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that study and what it showed about this validity and reliability.
It really was an important study in terms of having psychiatry really on the run, which it was in the 1970s. And it's getting back to that period again. We can talk a little bit about more the hopeful stuff of just, again, when something becomes so ludicrous, everybody starts to laugh at it and maybe mock it out of existence. But the Rosenhan study, which took place in 1973, is called Being Sane in Insane Places. And what he did just real briefly is he took he had a bunch of folks who were just normal pseudo-patients, and he told them to go to 12 different hospitals and pretend to have the psychotic symptom of hearing empty, hollow voices. And so all of them were able to fool the staff and get hospitalized. That wasn't the big part of the story. The big part of the story was that immediately after admission, these pseudo-patients were told to say that they no longer had these symptoms, and they behaved as normally as they were. And all the fellow patients knew that this was kind of they were either journalists or it was some experiment, but the psychiatrist wouldn't let them out. And so their average length of stay in the hospitals ranged from like 7 to 52 days, and so on their average it was 19 days, but some of them stayed there like as long as 52 days. And when they finally got discharged, none of the psychiatrists, no one ever had said, oh, we were just wrong, we made a mistake. What they did was they discharged them with a diagnosis. All of them were discharged with a diagnosis of schizophrenia in remission. And this was a big deal back in the 1970s. It was really something that really frightened psychiatry as people were laughing at it. And I think that's an important thing for people, not just when we're dealing with the pseudoscience of the DSM 4 or 5, with a lot of illegitimate authorities in everybody's lives, is that it's a big important, at some point, you have to just do more than talk about the illegitimacy of things. You have to be able to laugh at something. You have to mock it out of existence. And that's what was happening with psychiatry in the 1970s, with the Rosenhan study, with movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest that came out in mid-1970s and swept the Oscars in 1976, that psychiatry, the illegitimacy of its authority was being seen clearly, and it was really frightened. And there was good things happening all over the place in terms of rehumanizing all of mental health. Unfortunately, which a lot of folks who were fighting to delegitimize this illegitimate endeavor called psychiatry was, they were a little bit innocent, a little naive. They didn't realize that what psychiatry is going to do is not going to reform. What they were going to do is look for some big money backers. And that's what happened in the 1980s when psychiatry really went to bed with drug companies, was because they were afraid they were going to get laughed out of existence and they needed some big money behind you. And in America, as we know from just the whole political enterprise, if you've got enough money behind you, and drug companies had lots of money, you could get, you could stay afloat. You could pretty much convince people of almost anything. You could sell a politician. You could sell a war, and certainly you could sell all these mumbo jumbo biochemical imbalance theories and the DSM and all these other pseudoscientific things.
So, are we expected to believe that a Rosenhan type study couldn't be repeated in this day and age because of the advances in DSM 3, 4, and 5?
No, I mean, absolutely could be repeated. It has been, I don't know, not recently, but he did it again. And because the reality is that none of these mental illnesses in the DSM 3, 4, 5, the current DSM, none of these diagnoses are made on scientifically objective ways. None of them use lab tests or blood tests or brain scans or anything. They're based on what somebody's opinion is of another human being. And people behave differently with different human beings. People have different values. So the whole endeavor is just. You can just as easily fool people if you want to and get any kind of diagnosis you want, or there's no changes at all in the reliability of the diagnosis of any kind of psychiatric diagnosis.
Well, then you mentioned the idea of humanizing mental health. Let's talk about alternative models. If we weren't going to go away from this DSM model of having a Bible to try to diagnose people, how else could psychiatry function?
How else could psychiatry function? It probably couldn't. That's why it probably needs to just be eliminated. I mean, I don't know that it can be really reformed, psychiatry. I think it has to be pretty much eliminated, because the way, if you wanted to really rehumanize mental health, you wouldn't be categorizing, labeling people with these diseases because they were behaving in ways that were troubling to them or troubling to other people or self-destructive even. It's really of no help. These labels, not only are they scientifically not valid, they're just not clinically useful. There's just no value at all in the realm of emotional suffering, to be laying these kind of labels on people. We know that.
Well, as I mentioned, DSM-5 was published in May of this year, and so we've had several months now to see how it's being applied on the ground, so to speak. Do we have any statistics about prescriptions or anything that we can put our finger on about how the DSM-5 might have changed everyday practice for psychiatrists?
I don't see any statistics yet. It usually takes a couple of years for you to start seeing those kind of studies. They're just kind of counting the things up now, and then by the time things get published, it's usually a couple of years after the event happens that you start seeing the research on it.
All right. Well, I will once again direct people to your Huffington Post article on this subject from earlier this year, which will be linked up in the show notes for this interview. And, of course, I'll direct people to your website and to your books. But are there any other resources you'd like to direct people to on this subject specifically?
I've got a ton of articles on the pseudoscience of psychiatry, including the DSM. On my website, BruceLevine.net. And one of my earlier books, I go into a whole bunch of Common Sense Rebellion is an earlier book that I wrote in 2001 that talks about just the connection between all of these pseudo-diagnoses, not just from ADHD to ODD to depression, and just the kind of institutions that we live in and how they're all interconnected.
Excellent. All right. Well, I think we'll leave it there for now. But Dr. Levine, thank you so much for your time today. It's a fascinating conversation.
Great talking with you.